This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents Dead Ringer, A Western Trio by Louis L'Amour. This book is read by Lloyd James. Black Rock. 1. Jim Gatlin had been up the creek and over the mountains, and more than once had been on both ends of a six-shooter. Lean and tall, with shoulders wide for his height and a face like saddle leather, he was, at the moment, doing a workmanlike job of demolishing the last of a thick stake and picking off isolated beans that had escaped his initial attack. He was 1,000 miles from home and knew nobody in the town of Tucker. He glanced up as the door opened and saw a short, thick-bodied man. The man gave one startled look at Jim and ducked back out of sight. Gatlin blinked in surprise, then shrugged and filled his coffee cup from the pot standing on the restaurant table. Puzzled, he listened to the rapidly receding pound of a horse's hooves, then rolled a smoke, sitting back with a contented sigh. Some 250-odd miles to the north was the herd he had drifted northwest from Texas. The money the cattle had brought was in the belt around his waist and his pants pockets. Nothing remained now but to return to Texas, bank the profit, and pick up a new herd. The outer door opened again, and a tall girl entered the restaurant. Turning right, she started for the door leading to the hotel. She stopped abruptly as though his presence had only then registered. She turned, and her eyes widened in alarm. Swiftly, she crossed the room to him. "Are you insane?" she whispered. "Sitting here like that when the town is full of Wing Carey's hands? They know you're coming, and have been watching for you for days." Gatlin looked up, smiling.
"Ma'am, you sure got the wrong man, although if a girl as pretty as you is worried about him, he sure is a lucky fellow. I'm a stranger here. I never saw the place until an hour ago."
She stepped back, puzzled, and then the door slammed open once more, and a man stepped into the room. He was as tall as Jim, but thinner, and his dark eyes were angry.
"Get away from him, Lisa. I'm killing him right now."
The man's hand flashed for a gun, and Gatlin dived sidewise to the floor, drawing as he fell. A gun roared in the room, then Gatlin fired twice. The tall man caught himself, jerking his left arm against his ribs, his face twisted as he gasped for breath. Then he wilted slowly to the floor, his gun sliding from his fingers. Gatlin got to his feet, staring at the stranger. He swung his eyes to the girl staring at him.
"Who is that hombre?" he snapped. "What's this all about? Who did he think I was?"
You aren't Jim Walker?" Her voice was high, amazed.
"Walker?" He shook his head. "I'm sure as hell not. The name is Gatlin. I'm just drifting through."
There was a rush of feet in the street outside. She caught his hand. "Come, come quickly. They won't listen to you. They'll kill you. All the Carey outfit are in town." She ran beside him, dodging into the hotel and then swiftly down a hall. As the front door burst open, they plunged out the back and into the alley behind the building. Unerringly, she led him to the left and then opened the back door of another building and drew him inside. Silently, she closed the door and stood closely beside him, panting in the darkness. Shouts and curses rang from the building next door. A door banged and men charged up and down outside. Jim was still holding his gun, but now he withdrew the empty shells and fed two into the chamber to replace those fired. He slipped a sixth into the usually empty chamber.
"What is this place?" he whispered. "Will they come here?"
"It's a law office," she whispered. "I work here part-time, and I left the door open myself. They'll not think of this place." Stealthily, she lifted the bar and dropped it into place. "Better sit down. They'll be searching the streets for some time." He found the desk and seated himself on the corner, well out of line with the windows. He could see only the vaguest outline of her face. His first impression of moments before was strong enough for him to remember she was pretty. The gray eyes were wide and clear, her figure rounded yet slim.
"What is this?" he repeated. "What was he gunning for me for?"
"It wasn't you. He thought you were Jim Walker of the XY. If you aren't actually him, you look enough like him to be a brother, a twin brother.
Where is he? What goes on here? Who was that hombre who tried to gun me down?
She paused and seemed to be thinking, and he had the idea she was still uncertain whether to believe him or not. The man you killed was Bill Trout. He was the bad man of Paradise County, and Segundo on Wing Carey's Flying Sea Spread. Jim Walker called him a thief and a murderer in talking to Carey, and Trout threatened to shoot him on sight. Walker hasn't been seen since, and that was 4 days ago, so everybody believed Walker had skipped the country. Nobody blamed him much.
What's it all about? Gatlin inquired.
North of here, up beyond Black Rock, is Alder Creek country, with some rich bottom hayland lying in several corners of the mountains. This is dry country, but that Alder Creek area has springs and some small streams flowing down out of the hills. The streams flow into the desert and die there, so the water is good only for the man who controls the range.
And that was Walker?
No, up until 3 weeks ago, it was old Dave Butler. Then Dave was thrown from his horse and killed, and when they read his will, he had left the property to be sold at auction and the money to be paid to his nephew and niece back in New York. However, the joke was, he stipulated that Jim Walker was to get the ranch if he could bid $10,000 cash and $40,000 on his note, payable in 6 years.
In other words, he wanted Walker to have the property? Jim asked. He got first chance at it.
That's right. And I was to get second chance. If Jim didn't want to make the bid, I could have it for the same price. If neither of us wanted it, the ranch was to go on public auction, and that means that Carey or Horwick would get it. They have the money, and nobody around here could outbid them. The street outside was growing quieter as the excitement of the chase died down. I think, Lisa continued, that Uncle Dave wanted Jim to have the property because Jim did so much to develop it. Jim was the foreman of the XY, acting for Dave. Then Uncle Dave knew my father and liked me, and he knew I loved the ranch, so he wanted me to have second chance. But I don't have the money, and they all know it. Jim had some of it, and he could get the rest. I think that was the real issue behind his trouble with Trout. I believe Wing deliberately set Trout to kill him, and Jim's statements about Bill were a result of the pushing around Bill Trout had given him. The pattern was not unfamiliar, and Gatlin could easily appreciate the situation. Water was gold in this country of sparse grass. To a cattleman, such a ranch as Lisa described could be second to none, with plenty of water and grass and good hay meadows. Suddenly she caught his arm. Men were talking outside the door.
Looks like you got plumb away, Wing. Old Ben swears there was nobody in the room with him but that Lisa Cochran, and she never threw that gun. But how Jim Walker ever beat Trout is more than I can see. Why, Bill was the fastest man around here, unless it's you or me.
That wasn't Walker, Pete. It couldn't have been.
Ben swears it was, and Woody Hammer busted right through the door in front of him. Said it was Jim, all right.
Wing Carey's voice was irritable.
I tell you, it couldn't have been, he flared. Jim Walker never saw the day he dared face Trout with a gun. I've seen Walker draw, and he never was fast.
Maybe he wasn't, Pete Chasen agreed, dryly. But Trout's dead, ain't he?
3 days left, Carey said. Lisa Cochran hasn't the money, and it doesn't look like Walker will even be bidden. Let it ride, Pete. I don't think we need to worry about anything. Even if that was Walker, and I'd take an oath it wasn't, he's gone for good now. All we have to do is sit tight.
The two moved off, and Jim Gatlin, staring at the girl in the semi-darkness, saw her lips were tightly pressed. Her eyes had grown accustomed to the dim light, and she could see around the small office. It was a simple room with a desk, chair, and filing cabinets. Well-filled bookcases lined the walls. He got to his feet.
I've got to get my gear out of that hotel, he said, and my horse.
You're leaving? She asked. Jim glanced at her in surprise.
Why, sure. Why stay here in a fight that's not my own? I've already killed one man, and if I stay, I'll have to kill more, or be killed myself. There's nothing here for me.
Did you notice something? She asked suddenly. Wing Carey seemed very sure that Jim Walker wasn't coming back, that you weren't he.
Gatlin frowned. He had noticed it, and it had him wondering.
He did sound mighty sure, like he might know Walker wasn't coming back.
They were silent in the dark office, yet each knew what the other was thinking. Jim Walker was dead. Pete Chasen had not known it. Neither, obviously, had Bill Trout.
What happens to you, then? Gatlin asked suddenly. You lose the ranch?
She shrugged. I never had it. I never really thought I would have it. Only, well, if Jim had lived, I mean, if Jim got the ranch, we'd have made out. We were very close, like brother and sister. Now I don't know what I can do.
You haven't any people?
None that I know of. Her head came up suddenly. Oh, it isn't myself I'm thinking of. It's all the old hands, the ranch itself. Uncle Dave hated Carey, and so do his men. Now he'll get the ranch, and they'll all be fired, and he'll ruin the place. That's what he's wanted all along.
Catlin shifted his feet.
Tough, he said. Mighty tough.
He opened the door slightly.
Thanks, he said, for getting me out of there.
She didn't reply, so after a moment he stepped out of the door and drew it gently to behind him. There was no time to lose. He must get out of town by daylight, and with miles behind him, there was no sense getting mixed up in somebody else's fight, for all he'd get out of it would be a belly full of lead. There was nothing he could do to help. He moved swiftly, and within a matter of minutes was in his hotel room. Apparently searching for Jim Walker, they hadn't considered his room in the hotel. So Gatlin got his duffel together, stuffed it into his saddlebags, and picked up his rifle. With utmost care, he eased down the back stairs and into the alley. The streets were once more dark and still. What had become of the flying sea hands he didn't know, but none was visible. Staying on back streets, he made his way carefully to the livery barn, but there his chance of cover grew less, for he must enter the wide door with a light glowing over it. After listening, he stepped out and, head down, walked through the door. Turning, he hurried to the stall where his powerful black waited. It was the work of only a few minutes to saddle up. He led the horse out of the stall and caught up the bridle. As his hand grasped the pommel, a voice stopped him.
"Lighten out?"
It was Pete Chasen's voice. Slowly, he released his grip on the pommel and turned slightly. The man was hidden in a stall.
"Why not?" Gatlin asked. "I'm not going to be a shooting gallery for nobody. This ain't my range, and I'm sloping out of here for Texas. I'm no trouble hunter."
He heard Chasen's chuckle.
"Don't reckon you are. But it seems a shame not to make the most of your chance. What if I offered you $5,000 to stay? $5,000 in cash."
$5,000? Gatlin blinked. That was half as much as he had in his belt, and the $10,000 he carried had taken much hard work and bargaining to get. Buying a herd, chancing the long drive.
"What would I have to do?" he demanded.
Chasen came out of the stall.
"Be yourself," he said. "Just be yourself. But let folks think you're Jim Walker. Then you buy a ranch here. I'll give you the money, and then you hit the trail."
Chasen was trying to double-cross Carey? To get the ranch for himself? Gatlin hesitated.
"That's a lot of money, but these boys toss a lot of lead. I might not live to spend the dough."
"I'll hide you out," Chasen argued. "I've got a cabin in the hills. I'd hide you out with 4 or 5 of my boys to stand guard. You'd be safe enough. Then you could come down, put your money on the line, and sign the papers."
"Suppose they want Walker's signature checked. Jim Walker never signed more than 3, 4 papers in his life. He left no signatures hereabouts. I've took pains to be sure."
$5,000 because he looked like a man. It was easy money, and he'd be throwing a monkey wrench into Wing Carey's plans.
Carey, a man he'd decided he disliked.
"Sounds like a deal," he said. "Let's go."
The cabin on the north slope of Bartlett Peak was well hidden, and there was plenty of grub. Pete Chasen left him there with two men to guard him and two more standing by on the trail toward town. All through the following day, Jim Gatlin loafed, smoking cigarettes and talking idly with the two men. Hab Johnson was a big, unshaven hombre with a sullen face and a surly manner. He talked little, and then only to growl. Pink Stabenow was a wide-chested, flat-faced Jasper with an agreeable grin. Gatlin had a clear idea of his own situation. He could use the 5,000, but he knew Chasen never intended him to leave the country with it, and doubted if he would last an hour after the ranch was transferred to Chasen himself. Yet Gatlin had been around the rough country, and he knew a trick or two of his own. Several times he thought of Lisa Cochran, but avoided that angle as much as he could. After all, she had no chance to get the ranch, and Walker was probably dead. That left it between Carrie and Chasen. The unknown Horick, of whom he had heard mention, was around too, but he seemed to stand with Carrie in everything. Yet Gatlin was restless and irritable, and he kept remembering the girl beside him in the darkness, and her regrets at breaking up the old outfit. Jim Gatlin had been a hand who rode for the brand. He knew what it meant to have a ranch sold out from under a bunch of old hands. The home that had been theirs, gone. The friends drifting apart, never to meet again. Everything changed. He finished breakfast on the morning of the second day, then walked out of the cabin with his saddle. Hab Johnson looked up sharply.
"Where are you going?" he demanded.
"Riding," Gatlin said briefly. "And don't worry, I'll be back."
Johnson chewed a stem of grass, his hard eyes on Jim's.
"You ain't going nowheres. The boss said to watch you and keep you here. Here you stay."
Gatlin dropped his saddle.
"You aren't keeping me nowhere, Hab," he said flatly. "I've had enough sitting around. I aim to see a little of this country."
"I reckon not."
Hab got to his feet.
"You may be a fast hand with a gun, but you ain't getting both of us, and you ain't so foolish as to try."
He waved a big hand.
"Now you go back and sit down."
"I started for a ride," Jim said quietly. "And a ride I'm taking."
He stooped to pick up the saddle and saw Hab's boots as the big man started for him. Jim had lifted the saddle clear of the ground, and now he hurled it suddenly in Hab's path. The big man stumbled and hit the ground on his hands and knees, then started up. As he came up halfway, Jim slugged him. Hap tottered, fighting for balance, and Gatlin moved in, striking swiftly with a volley of lefts and rights to the head. Hab went down and hit hard, then came up with a lunge, but Gatlin dropped him again. Blood dripped from the smashed lips and a cut on his cheekbone. Gatlin stepped back, working his fingers. His hard eyes flicked to Pink Stabenow, who was smoking quietly, resting on one elbow, looking faintly amused.
"You stopping me?" Gatlin demanded.
Pink grinned.
"Me? Now where did you get an idea like that? Take your ride. Hab's just too persnickety about things. Anyway, he's always wanting to slug somebody. Now, maybe he'll be quiet for a spell."
There was a dim trail running northwest from the cabin, and Gatlin took it, letting his horse choose his own gait. The black was a powerful animal, not only good on a trail, but an excellent roping horse, and he moved out eagerly, liking the new country. When Gatlin had gone scarcely more than 2 miles, he skirted the edge of the high meadow with plenty of grass, then left the trail and turned off along a bench of the mountain, riding due north. Suddenly the mountain fell away before him, and below, in a long finger of grass, he saw the silver line of a creek, and nestled against a shoulder of the mountain, he discerned roofs among the trees. Pausing, Jim rolled a smoke and studied the lay of the land. Northward, for all of 10 miles, there was good range. Dry, but not so bad as over the mountain. And in the spring and early summer, it would be good grazing land. He had looked at too much range not to detect from the colors of the valley before him some of the varieties of grass and brush. Northwest, the range stretched away through a wide gap in the mountains, and he seemed to distinguish a deeper green in the distance. Old Dave Butler had chosen well, and his XY had been well handled, Gatlin could see as he rode nearer. Tanks had been built to catch some of the overflow from the mountains and to prevent the washing away of valuable range. The old man, and evidently Jim Walker, had worked hard to build this ranch into something. Even while wanting money for his relatives in the East, Butler had tried to ensure that the work would be continued after his death. Walker would continue it, and so would Lisa Cochran. 2. All morning he rode, and well into the afternoon, studying the range but avoiding the buildings. Once, glancing back, he saw a group of horsemen riding swiftly out of the mountains from which he had come and heading for the XY. Reining in, he watched from a vantage point among some huge boulders. Men wouldn't ride that fast without adequate reason. Morosely, he turned and started back along the way he had come, thinking more and more of Lisa. 5,000 was a lot of money, but what he was doing was not dishonest, and so far he had played the game straight. Still, why think of that? In a few days he'd have the money in his pocket and be headed for Texas. He turned on the brow of the hill and glanced back, carried away despite himself by the beauty of the wide sweep of range. Pushing on, he skirted around and came toward the cabin where he had been staying, off from the town trail. He was riding with his mind far away when the black snorted violently and shied. Jim drew up, staring at the man who lay sprawled in the trail. It was the cowhand Pete Chasen had left on guard there. He'd been shot through the stomach, and a horse had been ridden over him. Swinging down, a quick check showed that the man was dead. Jim grabbed up the reins and sprang into the saddle. Sliding a six-gun from its holster, he pushed forward, riding cautiously. The tracks told him that a party of 12 horsemen had come this way. He heard the wind in the trees, the distant cry of an eagle, but nothing more. He rode out into the clearing before the cabin and drew up. Another man had died here. It wasn't Stabenow or Hab Johnson, but the other guard, who must have retreated to this point for aid. Gun in hand, Gatlin pushed the door open and looked into the cabin. Everything was smashed. Yet, when he swung down and went in, he found his own gear intact, under the overturned bed. He threw his bedroll on his horse and loaded up his saddlebags. He jacked a shell into the chamber of the Winchester and was about to mount up when he heard a muffled cry. Turning, he stared around, then detected a faint stir among the leaves of a mountain mahogany. Warily, he walked over and stepped around the bush. Pink Stabenow, his face pale and his shirt dark with blood, lay sprawled on the ground. Curiously, there was still a faint touch of humor in his eyes when he looked up at Gatlin.
"Got me," he said finally. "It was that damned Hab. He sold us out to Wing Carey. The damned dirty..."
Jim dropped to his knees and gently unbuttoned the man's shirt. The wound was low down on the left side, and although he seemed to have lost much blood, there was a chance. Working swiftly, he built a fire, heated water, then bathed, and then dressed the wound. From time to time, Pink talked, telling him much of what he suspected, that Carey would hunt Chasen down now and kill him.
"If they fight," Jim asked, "who'll win?"
Stabenow grinned wryly. "Carey, he's tough and cold as ice. Pete's too jumpy. He's fast, but mark my words, if they face each other, he'll shoot too fast and miss his first shot. Wing won't miss, but it won't come to that. Wing's a cinch player. He'll chase him down, and the bunch will gun him to death. Wing's bloodthirsty."
Leaving food and a canteen of water beside the wounded man, and giving him 2 blankets, Jim Gatlin mounted. His deal was off then. The thought left him with a distinct feeling of relief. He had never liked any part of it, and he found himself without sympathy for Pete Chasen. The man had attempted a double cross and failed. Well, the road was open again now, and there was nothing between him and Texas but the miles. Yet, he hesitated, and then turned his horse toward the XY. He rode swiftly, and at sundown was at the ranch. He watched it for a time and saw several hands working around, yet there seemed little activity. No doubt they were waiting to see what was to happen. Suddenly, a sorrel horse started out from the ranch and swung into the trail toward town. Jim Gatlin squinted his eyes against the fading glare of the sun and saw the rider was a woman. That would be Lisa Cochran. Suddenly he swung the black and, touching spurs to the horse, raced down the mountain to intercept her. Until that moment he had been uncertain as to the proper course, but now he knew. Yet for all his speed, his eyes were alert and watchful, for he realized the risk he ran. Wing Carey would be quick to discover that as long as he was around and alive, there was danger. And even now the rancher might have his men out, scouring the country for him. Certainly there were plausible reasons enough, for it could be claimed that he had joined with Chasen in a plot to get the ranch by pretending to be Jim Walker. Lisa's eyes widened when she saw him. I thought you'd be gone by now. There's a posse after you.
You mean some of Carey's men?
He corrected. I mean a posse. Wing has men on your trail, too, but they lost you somehow. He claims you were tied up in a plan with Pete Chasen to get the ranch, and that you killed Jim Walker. His eyes searched her face.
You mean he actually claims that?
She nodded, watching him. He says that story about your being here was all nonsense, that you actually came on purpose, that you and Chasen rigged it that way. You'll have to admit it looks funny, you arriving right at this time and looking just like Jim.
What if it does?
He demanded impatiently.
I never heard of Jim Walker until you mentioned him to me, and I never heard of the town of Tucker until a few hours before I met you.
You'd best go then, she warned. They're all over the country. Sheriff Eaton would take you in, but Wing wouldn't, nor any of his boys. They'll kill you on sight.
Yeah, he agreed. I can see that.
Nevertheless, he didn't stir, but continued to roll a cigarette. She sat still, watching him curiously. Finally, he looked up.
I'm in a fight, he admitted, and not one I asked for. Carey is making this a mighty personal thing, ma'am, and I reckon I ain't even figuring on leaving.
He struck a match.
You got any chance of getting the ranch?
How could I? I have no money.
Supposing, he suggested, squinting an eye against the smoke, you had a partner with $10,000.
Lisa shook her head. Things like that don't happen, she said. They just don't.
I've got $10,000 on me, Gatlin volunteered, and I've been pushed into this whether I like it or not. I say we ride into Tucker now, and we see this boss of yours, the lawyer. I figure he could get the deal all set up for us tomorrow. Are you game?
You really have that much? She looked doubtfully at his shabby range clothes. It's honest money?
I drove cattle to Montana, he said. That was my piece of it. Let's go. Not so fast, the words rapped out sharply. I'll take that money and take it now. Woody, get the girl.
For reply, Jim slapped the spurs to the black and, at the same instant, slapped the sorrel a ringing blow. The horses sprang off together in a dead run. Behind them, a rifle shot rang out, and Jim felt the bullet clip past his skull.
Keep going, he yelled. Ride!
At a dead run, they swung down the trail, and then Jim saw a side trail he had noticed on his left. He jerked his head at the girl and grabbed at a bridle. It was too dark to see the gesture, but she felt the tug and turned the sorrel after him, mounting swiftly up the steep side hill under the trees. There, the soft needles made it impossible for their horses' hooves to be heard, and Jim led the way, pushing on under the pines. That it would be only a minute or so before Carey discovered his error was certain, but each minute counted. A wall lifted on their right, and they rode on, keeping in the intense darkness close under it. But then another wall appeared on their left, and they were boxed in. Behind them, they heard a yell, distant now, but indication enough their trail had been found. Boulders and slabs of rock loomed before them, but the black horse turned down a slight incline and worked his way around the rocks. From time to time, they spoke to each other to keep together, but he kept moving, knowing that Wing Carey would be close behind. The canyon walls seemed to be drawing closer, and the boulders grew larger and larger. Somewhere Jim heard water running, and the night air was cool and slightly damp on his face. He could smell pine, so he knew that there were trees about, and they had not ridden completely out of them. Yet Jim was becoming worried, for the canyon walls towered above them,
and obviously there was no break. If this turned out to be a box canyon, they were bottled up. One man could hold this canyon corked with no trouble at all. The black began to climb and in a few minutes walked out on a flat of grassy land. The moon was rising, but as yet there was no light in this deep canyon. Lisa rode up beside him. Jim? It was the first time she had ever called him by his name. I'm afraid we're in for it now. Unless I'm mistaken, this is a box canyon. I've never been up here, but I've heard of it, and there's no way out.
I was afraid of that.
The black horse stopped as he spoke, and he heard water falling ahead. He urged the horse forward, but he refused to obey. Jim swung down into the darkness.
Pool, he said. We'll find some place to hold up and wait for daylight.
They found a group of boulders and seated themselves among them, stripping the saddles from their horses and picketing them on a small patch of grass behind the boulders. Then, for a long time, they talked the casual talk of two people finding out about each other. Jim talked of his early life on the Noches, of his first trip into Mexico after horses when he was 14, and how they were attacked by Apaches. There had been 3 Indian fights that trip, 2 south of the border and 1 north of it. He had no idea when sleep took him, but he awakened with a start to find the sky growing gray and to see Lisa Cochran sleeping on the grass 6 feet away. She looked strangely young, with her face relaxed and her lips slightly parted. A dark tendril of hair had blown across her cheek. He turned away and walked out to the horses. The grass was thick and rich here. He studied their position with care and found they were on a terrace separated from the end wall of the canyon only by the pool, at least an acre of clear, cold water into which a small fall poured from the cliff above. There were a few trees and some of the scattered boulders they had encountered the previous night. The canyon on which they had come was a wild jumble of boulders and brush surmounted on either side by cliffs that lifted nearly 300 feet. While escape might be impossible if Wing Carry attempted, as he surely would, to guard the opening, their own position was secure, too, for one man with a rifle might stand off an army from the terrace. After he had watered the horses, he built a fire and put water on for coffee. Seeing some trout in the pool, he tried his luck, and from the enthusiasm with which they went for his bait, the pool could never have been fished before, or not in a long time. Lisa came from behind the boulders just as the coffee came to a boil. "What is this, a picnic?" she asked brightly. He grinned, touching his unshaven jaw.
"With this beard?"
He studied her a minute.
"You'd never guess you'd spent the night on horseback or sleeping at the end of a canyon," he said.
Then his eyes sobered.
"Can you handle a rifle? I mean, well enough to stand off Carrie's boys if they tried to come up here?"
She turned quickly and glanced down the canyon. The nearest boulders to the terrace edge were 60 yards away, and the approach, even that close, would not be easy. "I think so," she said. "What are you thinking of?" He gestured at the cliff.
"I've been studying that. With a mite of luck, a man might make it up there."
Her face paled.
"It isn't worth it. We're whipped, and we might as well admit it. All we can do now is sit still and wait until the ranch is sold."
"No," he said positively. "I'm going out of here if I have to blast my way out. They've made a personal matter out of this now, and..." He glanced at her. "I sort of have a feeling you should have that ranch. Looking at it yesterday, I just couldn't imagine it without you. You lived there, didn't you?"
"Most of my life. My folks were friends of Uncle Dave's, and after they were killed, I stayed on with him."
"Did he leave you anything?"
he asked. She shook her head. I think he expected me to marry Jim. He always wanted it that way, but we never felt that way about each other. And yet Jim told me after Uncle Dave died that I was to consider the place my home, if he got it."
As they ate, he listened to her talk while he studied the cliff. It wasn't going to be easy, and yet it could be done. A shot rang out from the rocks behind them, and they both moved to the boulders, but there was nobody in sight. A voice yelled again that Jim spotted as that of Wing Carry. He shouted a reply, and Wing yelled back,
"Well, let Lisa come out if she wants. And you too, if you come with your hands up."
Lisa shook her head, so Gatlin shouted back,
We like it here. Plenty of water. Plenty of grub. If you want us, you'll have to come and get us.
In the silence that followed, Lisa said, He can't stay, not if he attends the auction. Jim turned swiftly.
Take the rifle. If they start to come, shoot, and shoot to kill. I'm going to take a chance.
Keeping out of sight behind the worn gray boulders, Gatlin worked his way swiftly along the edge of the pool toward the cliff face. As he felt his way along the rocky edge, he stared down into the water. That pool was deep, from the looks of it, and that was something to remember. At the cliff face, he stared up. It looked even easier than he thought, and at one time and another he had climbed worse faces. However, once he was well up the face, he would be within sight of the watchers below. Or would he? 3. He put a hand up and started working his way to a 4-inch ledge that projected from the face of the rock and slanted sharply upward. There were occasional clumps of brush growing from the rock, and they would offer some security. A rifle shot rang out behind him, then a half dozen more farther off. Lisa had fired at something, and had been answered from down the canyon. The ledge was steep, but there was good handholds, and he worked his way along it more swiftly than he would have believed possible. His clothing blended well with the rock, and by refraining from any sudden movements there was a chance that he could make it. When almost 200 feet up the face, he paused, resting on a narrow ledge, partly concealed by an outcropping. He looked up, but the wall was sheer. Beyond, there was a chimney, but almost too wide for climbing, and the walls looked slick as a blue clay side hill. Yet, study the cliff as he would, he could see no other point where he might climb farther. Worse, part of that chimney was exposed to fire from below. If they saw him, he was through. He'd be stuck with no chance of evading their fire. Yet, he knew he'd take the chance. Squatting on the ledge, he pulled off his boots, and, running a loop of pigging string through their loops, he slung them from his neck. Slipping thongs over his guns, he got into the chimney and braced his back against one side, then lifted his feet, first his left, then his right, against the opposite wall. Whether Lisa was watching or not, he didn't know, but almost at that instant she began firing. The chimney was, at this point, all of 6 feet deep and wide enough to allow for climbing, but very risky climbing. His palms flat against the slippery wall, he began to inch himself upward, working his stocking feet up the opposite wall. Slowly, every movement a danger, his breath coming slowly, his eyes riveted on his feet, he began to work his way higher. Sweat poured down his face and smarted in his eyes, and he could feel it trickling down his stomach under his wool shirt. Before he was halfway up, his breath was coming in great gasps, and his muscles were weary with the strain of opposing their strength against the walls to keep from falling. Then, miraculously, the chimney narrowed a little, and climbing was easier. He glanced up. Not over 20 feet to go. His heart bounded, and he renewed his effort. A foot slipped, and he felt an agonizing moment when fear throttled him, and he seemed about to fall. To fall meant to bound from that ledge and go down, down into that deep green pool at the foot of the cliff, a fall of nearly 300 feet. Something smacked against the wall near him, and from below there was a shout. Then Lisa opened fire, desperately, he knew, to give him covering fire. Another shot splashed splinters in his face, and he struggled wildly, sweat pouring from him, to get up those last few feet. Suddenly the rattle of fire ceased, and then opened up again. He risked a quick glance and saw Lisa Cochran running out in the open, and, as she ran, she halted and fired. She was risking her life, making her death or capture inevitable, to save him. Suddenly a breath of air was against his cheek, and he hunched himself higher, his head reaching the top of the cliff. Another shot rang out and howled off the edge of the rock beside him. Then his hands were on the edge, and he rolled over onto solid ground, trembling in every limb. There was no time to waste. He got to his feet, staggering, and stared around. He was on the very top of the mountain, and Tucker lay far away to the south. He seated himself and got his boots on, then slipped the thongs from his guns. Walking as swiftly as his still trembling muscles would allow, he started south. There was a creek, he remembered, that flowed down into the flatlands from somewhere near there.
an intermittent stream, but with a canyon that offered an easy outlet to the plain below. Studying the terrain, he saw a break in the rocky plateau that might be it, and started down the steep mountainside through the cedar, toward that break. A horse was what he needed most. With a good horse under him, he might make it. He had a good lead, for they must come around the mountain, a good 10 miles by the quickest trail. That 10 miles might get him to town before they could catch him. To town, and to the lawyer who would make the bid for them, even if Eaton had him in jail by that time. Suddenly, remembering how Lisa had run out into the open, risking her life to protect him, he realized he would willingly give his own to save her. He stopped, mopping his face with a handkerchief. The canyon broke away before him, and he dropped into it, sliding and climbing to the bottom. When he reached the bottom, he started off toward the flat country at a swinging stride. A half hour later, his shirt dark with sweat, the canyon suddenly spread widely into the flat country. Dust hung in the air, and he slowed down, hearing voices.
"Give him a blow," it was a man's voice speaking. "Hear any more shooting?"
"Not me,"
the second voice was thin and nasal.
"Reckon it was my ears mistaking themselves."
"Let's go, Eaton," another voice said. "It's too hot here. I'm pining for some of that good XY well water."
Gatlin pushed his way forward.
"Hold on, Sheriff. You hunting me?"
Sheriff Eaton was a tall, gray-haired man with a handlebar mustache and keen blue eyes.
"If you're Gatlin, and from the looks of you, you must be. I sure am. How come you're so all-fired anxious to get caught?"
Gatlin explained swiftly.
"Lisa Cochran's back there, and they got her," he finished. "Sheriff, I'd be mighty pleased if you'd send a few men after her. Or go yourself and let the rest of them go to Tucker with me."
Eaton studied him.
"What do you want in Tucker?"
"To bid that ranch in for Lisa Cochran," he said flatly. "Sheriff, that girl saved my bacon back there, and I'm a grateful man. You get me to town to get that money in Lawyer Ashton's hands, and I'll go to jail." Eaton rolled his jaw in his lean jaws.
"Dave Butler come over the cutoff with me, seen this ranch then, and would have it no other way but that he come back here to settle. I reckon I know what he wanted."
He turned.
"Doc, you'll get none of that XY water today. Take this man to Ashton, then put him in jail, and make her fast."
Doc was a lean, saturnine man with a lantern jaw and cold eyes. He glanced at Gatlin, then nodded as he handed the reins of the extra horse they had brought to Gatlin.
"If you say so, Sheriff. I sure was hoping for some of that good XY water, though. Come on, partner."
They wheeled their horses and started for Tucker, Doc turning from the trail to cross the desert through a thick tangle of cedar and sagebrush.
"Might quicker this-a-way. Ain't nobody ever rides it, and she's some rough."
It was high noon, and the sun was blazing. Doc led off, casting only an occasional glance back at Gatlin. Jim was puzzled, for the man made no show of guarding him. Was he deliberately offering him the chance to make a break? It looked it, but Jim wasn't having any. His one idea was to get to Tucker, see Ashton, and get his money down. They rode on, pushing through the dancing heat waves, no breeze stirring the air, and the sun turning the bowl into a baking oven. Doc slowed the pace a little.
"Hosses won't stand it," he commented,
then glanced at Gatlin.
"I reckon you're honest. You had a chance for a break and didn't take it."
He grinned wryly.
"Not that you'd have got far. This here rifle of mine sure shoots where I aim it at."
"I've got nothing to run from," Gatlin replied. "What I've said was true. My being in Tucker was strictly accidental." The next half mile they rode side by side, entering now into a devil's playground of boulders and arroyos. Doc's hand went out, and Jim drew up. Buzzards roosted in a tree not far off the trail, a half dozen of the great birds.
"Something's dead," Doc said. "Let's have a look."
200 yards farther, and they drew up. What had been a dappled gray horse lay in a saucer-like depression among the cedars. Buzzards lifted from it, flapping their great wings. Doc's eyes glinted, and he spat.
"Jim Walker's mare," he said, "and his saddle."
They pushed on, circling the dead horse. Catlin pointed.
Look, he said. He wasn't killed. He was crawling away.
Yeah. Doc was grim. But not far. Look at the blood he was losing.
They got down from their horses, their faces grim. Both men knew what they'd find, and neither man was looking forward to the moment. Doc slid his rifle from the scabbard.
Jim Walker was by way of being a friend of mine, he said. I take his going right hard.
The trail was easy. Twice the wounded man had obviously lain still for a long time. They found torn cloth where he had ripped up his shirt to bandage a wound. They walked on until they saw the gray rocks and the foot of the low bluff. It was a cul-de-sac.
Wait a minute, Gatlin said. Look at this.
He indicated the tracks of a man who had walked up the trail. He had stopped there, and there was blood on the sage. Spattered blood. The faces of the men hardened, for the deeper impression of one foot, the way the step was taken, and the spattered blood told but one thing. The killer had walked up and kicked the wounded man. They had little farther to go. The wounded man had nerve, and nothing had stopped him. He was backed up under a clump of brush that drew from the side of the bluff, and he lay on his face. That was an indication to these men that Walker had been conscious for some time, that he had sought a place where the buzzards couldn't get at him. Doc turned, and his gray-white eyes were icy.
Step your boot beside that track, he said, his rifle partly lifted.
Jim Gatlin stared back at the man and felt cold and empty inside. At that moment, familiar with danger as he was, he glad he wasn't the killer. He stepped over to the tracks and made a print beside them. His boot was almost an inch shorter and of a different type.
Didn't figure so, Doc said, but I aim to make sure.
On the wall, there, Gatlin said. He scratched something. Both men bent over. It was plain, scratched with an edge of whitish rock on the slate of a small slab. Cary Dunn. And no more. Doc straightened.
He can wait a few hours more. Let's get to town.
Tucker Street was more crowded than usual when they rode up to Ashton's office and swung down. Jim Gatlin pulled open the door and stepped in. The tall, gray-haired man behind the desk looked up.
You're Ashton? Gatlin demanded.
At the answering nod, he opened his shirt and unbuckled his money belt.
There's 10,000 here. Bid in the XY for Cochran and Gatlin.
Ashton's eyes sparkled with sudden satisfaction.
Are you her partner? He asked.
You're putting up the money?
It's a fine thing you're doing, man.
I'm a partner only in name. My gun backs the brand, that's all. She may need a gun behind her for a little while, and I've got it.
He turned to Doc, but the man was gone. Briefly, Gatlin explained what they had found and added,
Wing Carey's heading for town now.
Headed for town?
Ashton's head jerked around.
He's here. Came in about 20 minutes ago.
Jim Gatlin spun on his heel and strode from the office. On the street, pulling his hat brim low against the glare, he stared left, then right. There were men on the street, but they were drifting inside now. There was no sign of the man called Doc or of Cary. Catlin's heels were sharp and hard on the boardwalk. He moved swiftly, his hands swinging alongside his guns. His hard brown face was cool, and his lips were tight. At the barrel house, he paused, put up his left hand, and stepped in. All faces turned toward him, but none was that of Cary.
Seen Wayne Cary? He demanded. He murdered Jim Walker.
Nobody replied. And then an oldish man turned his head and jerked it down the street.
He's getting his hair cut. Right next to the livery barn. Waiting for the auction to start up.
Gatlin stepped back through the door. A dark figure, hunched near the blacksmith shop, jerked back from sight. Jim hesitated, alert to danger, then quickly pushed on. The red and white barber pole marked the frame building. Jim opened the door and stepped in. A sleeping man snored with his mouth open, his back to the street wall. The bald barber looked up, swallowed, and stepped back. Wayne Cary sat in the chair, his hair half-trimmed, the white cloth draped around him. The opening door and sudden silence made him look up.
You, is it?
He said. It's me. We found Jim Walker. He marked your name, Carrie, as his killer. Carrie's lips tightened, and suddenly a gun bellowed, and something slammed Jim Gatlin in the shoulder and spun him like a top, smashing him sidewise into the door. That first shot saved him from the second. Wing Carrie had held a gun in his lap and fired through the white cloth. There was sneering triumph in his eyes, and, as though time stood still, Jim Gatlin saw the smoldering of the black-rimmed circles of the holes in the cloth. He never remembered firing, but suddenly Carrie's body jerked sharply, and Jim felt the gun buck in his hand. He fired again, and Wing's face twisted, and his gun exploded into the floor, narrowly missing his own foot. Wing started to get up, and Gatlin fired a third time, the shot nicking Wing's ear and smashing a shaving cup, spattering lather. The barber was on his knees in one corner, holding a chair in front of him. The sleeping man had dived through the window, glass and all. Men came running, and Jim leaned back against the door. One of the men was Doc, and he saw Sheriff Eaton, and then Lisa tore them aside and ran to him. Oh, you're hurt. You've been shot. You've... His feet gave away slowly, and he slid down the door to the floor. Wing Carrie still sat in the barbershop chair, his hair half-clipped. Doc stepped in and glanced at him, then at the barber.
You can't charge him for it, Tony. You never finished.
Gamble of the KT. For 3 days, Shandy Gamble had been lying on his back in the Paragord house awaiting the stranger with the black mustache. Nichols, his name was, thinking if they were going to start cattle buying, they had better be moving. The season was already late. Shandy Gamble was 17 years old and tall for his age. In fact, he was tall for any age. 4 inches over 6 feet, he was all feet, hands, and shoulders. With his shirt off, you could count every rib in his lean body. Paragord was the biggest town Shandy had ever seen. In fact, it was only the third town he had seen in his life. With the cattle buyers in town, there was almost 1,000 head of folks, and on the street, Shandy felt uncomfortable and mighty crowded. Most of his time he spent down at the horse corrals or lying on his bed, waiting for Nichols. He had come to town to buy himself a new saddle and bridle, maybe a new hat and shirt. He was a saving man, Shandy Gamble was, despite his youth. Now he not only was holding his own money, but $500 belonging to Nichols. Had it not been for that, he wouldn't have waited, for by now he was homesick for the KT outfit. Nichols was a big, powerful man with a smooth, shaved face and black, prominent eyes. He also had black hair and a black mustache. Shandy had been leaning on the corral gate when Nichols had first approached him.
Good afternoon, sir.
Nichols had thrust out a huge hand.
I understand you're a cattleman.
Shandy Gamble blinked. Nobody had ever called him a cattleman before, and his chest swelled appreciably. He was a $40-a-month cowhand, although at the moment he did have $552 in his pocket. $52 was saved from his wages, and the $500 was half the reward money for nailing 2 horse thieves back in the Cedar Country. Shandy had tracked them back there for Deputy Sheriff Holloway, and when they killed Holloway, he got mad and went in after them. He brought one out dead, and one so badly mauled he wished he was dead. There was $1,000 on their heads, and Shandy tried to give it to Mrs. Holloway, but she would accept only half. Thinking about Nichols now, Shandy shifted uneasily on the bed. It was time Nichols got back. The proposition had sounded good, no question about that.
You can't beat it, Gamble, Nichols had said. You know cattle, and I've the connections in Kansas City and Chicago. We can ride over the country buying cattle, then ship and sell them. A nice profit for both of us.
That would take money, and I ain't got much. Shandy had said.
Nichols eyed him thoughtfully. No use telling the boy he had seen that roll when Shandy paid for his room in advance.
It won't take much to start,
Nichols scowled as he considered the size of Shandy's roll.
Say, $1,000.
Shucks, Shandy was regretful. I ain't got but $500.
Fine!
Nichols clapped him on the shoulder.
We're partners, then. You put up 500, and I'll put up 500. We'll bank that here, and then start buying. I've got unlimited credit east of here, and when the 1,000 is gone, we'll draw on that. At this stage, you'll be the one doing most of the thinking, so you don't need to put as much cash into it as I do.
Well, Shandy had not been sure. It sounded like a good deal, and who knew cows better than he did? He had been practically raised with cows.
Maybe it would be a good deal, he said. Old Ed France has a herd nobody's looked at. Nice fat stock, too.
Good. Nichols clapped him on the shoulder again. From his pocket, he took a long brown envelope and a sheaf of bills. Very carefully, he counted off $500 and stuck it into the envelope.
Now, your 500.
Shandy dug down and hauled out his bills and counted off the $500 and tucked it into the envelope.
Now, Nichols started to put the envelope in his pocket. We'll go to the bank and...
He stopped, then withdrew the envelope.
No, you just keep this on you. We'll bank it later.
Shandy Gamble accepted the fat envelope and stuck it into his shirt. Nichols glanced at his watch, then rubbed his jaw.
Tell you what, Nichols said. I've got to catch the stage for Holbrook. I'll be back tomorrow night. You stick around, and whatever you do, don't let this money out of your hands. I'll see you back at the hotel.
Shandy watched him go, shrugged, and went back to watching the horses. There was a fine black gelding there. If he was a cattle buyer, he would own that gelding, buy a new saddle and bridle, and some fancy clothes like Jim Finnegan wore, and he would show that outfit back on the KT. Now, the wait for Nichols was dampening his enthusiasm for becoming a cattle buyer. Truth was, he liked the KT, and liked working with the boys. They were a good outfit. He rolled over on the bed and swung his feet to the floor. Reaching for his boots, he shoved his big feet into them and stood up. To blazes with it! He'd open the envelope, leave the money in the bank for Nichols, and go back to the outfit. He was no cattle buyer anyway. He was a cowhand. Taking out the brown envelope, he ripped it open. Slowly, he turned cold and empty inside, and stood there, his jaw slack, his shock of corn silk hair hanging over his face. The envelope was stuffed with old newspaper pieces. The spring grass faded from green to brown, and dust gathered in the trails. Waterholes shrank, and the dried earth cracked around them, and the cattle grew gaunt. It was a hard year on the Caprock, and that meant work for the hands. Shandy Gamble was in the saddle 18 to 20 hours most days, rounding up strays and pushing them south to the gullies and remaining waterholes. When he had returned from Perigord without his saddle, there was a lot of jawing about it, and the boys all had poked fun at Shandy, but he had grinned widely and taken it, letting them believe he had drunk it up or spent it on women. Jim Finnegan rode out one day on a gray horse. He was looking the situation over and making estimates on the beef to be had after the fall roundup. Shandy was drifting south with 3 head of gaunted stock when they met. Gamble drew up and Finnegan joined him.
Howdy, son. Stock looks poor.
Yeah, Shandy dug for the makings.
We need rain plumb bad.
He rolled his smoke, then asked quietly,
You ever hear of a buyer named Nichols? Big, black-eyed man?
Shandy's description was accurate and painstaking, the sort of description a man might give who was used to reading signs, and who 30 seconds after a glimpse of a horse or cow could describe its every hair and ailment.
Nichols, you've forgotten the name, son. No, the hombre you describe is Abel Koch. He's a card slick and confidence man. Brute of a fighter, too. Brags you never saw the man could stand up to him in a fistfight.
Seen him around?
Yeah. He was around Fort Worth earlier this year. He rousts around with the June boys.
The June boys. There were 5 of the Junes. The old man, Pete June, and the 4 outlaw sons, Alec, Tom, Buck, and Windy. All were gunslicks. Bad men, dirty, unkempt drifters known to be killers, believed to be horse and cow thieves, and suspected of some out-and-out murders.
Two nights later, back at the bunkhouse, Johnny Smith rode in with the mail, riding down from Tuckup way, where he had stopped to ask after some iron work being done for the ranch by the Tuckup blacksmith. Tuckup was mostly an outlaw town, but the blacksmith there was the best around. Cowhands do most of their own work, but the man at Tuckup could make anything with iron, and the KT boss had been getting some fancy andirons made for his fireplace.
"Killing over to Tuckup," Johnny said as he swung down. "That's Sullivan from Brandy Canyon, tangled with Windy June. Windy bored him plenty."
Shandy Gamble's head went up. "June? The rest of that outfit there?" he asked.
"Sure, the whole shooting match of June's."
"Big black-eyed fellow with him? Black mustache?"
"Koch?"
"Sure as you know he is. He whooped the blacksmith. Beat him so bad he couldn't finish the old man's andirons.
That's a rough outfit."
The boss of the KT was talking to Jim Finnegan when Shandy strolled up.
Boss, anything you want done over Tuckup way? I got a ride over there."
The boss glanced at him sharply. It was unlike Gamble to ask permission to go away from his work. He was a good hand and worked like two men. If he wanted to go to Tuckup, there was a reason.
"Yeah, ask about my irons again. Two, you might have a look up around the water pocket. We're missing some cows. If you find them or see any suspicious tracks, come a-hootin' and we'll ride up that way."
Shandy Gamble was going to borrow a buckskin that belonged to the KT. He was a short coupled horse with a wide head, good at cutting or roping, but a good trail horse too. Johnny Smith, who was mending a bridle, glanced up in time to see Gamble going out of the door with his rifle in his hand. That was not unusual, with plenty of wolves and lions around, but Shandy was wearing two guns, something that hadn't happened for a long time. Johnny's brow puckered. Then he shrugged and went back to work on the bridle. The Tuckup Trail was a scar across the face of the desert. It was a gash in the plateau, and everywhere was rock. Red rock, pink rock, white, yellow, and buff rock, twisted and gnarled into weird shapes. By night it was a ghost land where a wide moon floated over the blasted remains of ancient mountains, and by day it was an oven blazing with heat and dancing with dust devils and heat-waved distance. Tuckup was a cluster of shabby down-at-the-heel buildings tucked back into a hollow among the rocks. It boasted that there was a grave in Boot Hill for every living person in town, and they always had two empty graves, waiting to receive the next customers. Tuckup was high, and despite the blazing heat of the day, a fire was usually welcome at night. The King High Saloon was the town's resort, meeting place, and hangout. Second only to it was the stable, a rambling, gloomy building full of stalls for 60 horses and a loft full of hay. Shandy Gamble stabled his horse and gave it a good rub down. It had a hard ride ahead of it, for he knew that there would be no remaining in town after he had done what he had to do. Lean, gangling, and slightly stooped, he stood in the stable door and rolled a smoke. His shoulders seemed excessively broad about the narrow hips, and the 244s hung with their butts wide and easy to his big hands. He wore jeans and a faded checked shirt. His hat was gray, dusty, and battered. There was a hole through the crown that one of the horse thieves he had chased had put there. He studied the town. There was the saloon, a general store, the blacksmith shop, and a livery stable. Beyond and around was a scattering of a dozen or so houses, mostly mere shacks. Then there were two bunkhouses that called themselves hotels. Shandy Gamble walked slowly across to the blacksmith shop. The smith was a burly man, and when he looked up, Shandy saw a deep, half-healed cut on his cheekbone, and an eye still swollen and dark.
"KT Irons ready?"
Shandy asked, to identify himself.
"Will be,"
the smith stared at him.
"Rider from there just here yesterday. Your boss must be in a mighty hurry."
"Ain't that. I had some business over here." "Know an hombre named a Koch?"
The smith glared at him.
"You being funny?"
"No. I got business with him."
"Trouble?"
"Uh-huh. I'm going to beat his head in."
The smith shrugged.
"Try it if you want. I done tried, but not no more. He darn near killed me.
He won't kill me.
Your funeral. He's up at the King High.
The smith looked at him.
You be careful. Them Junes is up there, too.
He wiped his mustache.
KT, you better think again. You're only a kid.
My feet makes as big tracks as his'n.
Going in, they may. Coming out, they may be a sight smaller.
Shandy Gamble's eyes were chill. Like you said, it's my funeral. He hitched his guns in place and started across the street. He was almost to the hitch rail in front of the King High when he saw a fresh hide hung over the fence. It was still bloody. Curiously, he walked back. The brand had been cut away from the rest of the hide. Poking around in a pile of refuse ready for burning, he found it, scraped it clean, and tucked it into his pocket. He was turning when he looked up to see a man standing near him. He was several inches shorter than Shandy, but he was wide and blocky. He wore his gun tied down, and he looked mean. His cheeks were hollow, and his eyes small.